From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, President Obama sends the Green Berets to train Iraqi security forces, but he's not ready to launch airstrikes.
And going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it.
We talked to an analyst in Iraq who says people there don't want American intervention. Also, Julian Assange marks his second year hold up in London's Ecuadorian embassy. The former top man at Scotland Yard says the police operation outside the building is a waste of money.
Why on earth you have to have a police presence here? I've got no idea.
And Hillary Clinton on Vladimir Putin and climate change. That's ahead on today's FSN Reports after our summary of the main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. American forces will not be returning to Iraq. That's the message from U.S. President Barack Obama, who is instead deploying up to 300 so-called military advisors to train and advise the Iraqi army. The return of U.S. special forces to Iraq follows territorial advances made by ISIS militants. Washington correspondent Nina Maria Potts reports.
In a carefully worded statement, the U.S. president said American troops are not returning to Iraq. He said he was deploying instead 300 military advisors to help retrain the Iraqi army. The U.S. is boosting its intelligence operations in the region and is also adding security to its mission in Baghdad. President Obama said he's not ready to launch airstrikes at this stage, but he didn't rule them out either.
There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process.
The president appealed to Iraq's neighbors to respect the country's borders, but sent the strongest signal yet to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to form an inclusive government, warning the U.S. cannot solve Iraq's problems unless it solves them itself.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has confirmed he will sign an association agreement with the EU on June 27th. This is the deal that former pro-Moscow-leaning President Viktor Yanukovych backed out of signing, leading to protest and outcry from Ukrainian civilians. Meanwhile, Moscow has confirmed it has boosted its military presence along the Ukrainian border. NATO reports several thousand Russian troops have been deployed in a reversal of an earlier decision to pull away from the border. The move comes after pro-Russian separatists rejected calls to put down weapons in a ceasefire proposed by President Poroshenko. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu says Moscow will hold military drills close to the Ukrainian border in response to the activation of NATO forces in the region. At a closed meeting at the lower house of the Russian parliament, Mr. Shoigu also said it would be technically feasible to establish a no-fly zone over southeastern Ukraine, but that politically it is not possible. Russian media report that the defense ministry has decided to increase its presence in the Rostov and Belgorod regions after Ukrainian military activities along the border and attacks on Russian embassies across the country.
Spain has sworn in its new king, Felipe VI, in a ceremony in the Spanish parliament. He takes over the reign from his father, Juan Carlos, who recently abdicated. Europe correspondent Jack Perrock has more.
46-year-old King Felipe acceded to the throne at the stroke of midnight local time. His father, Juan Carlos, adorned him with the royal red sash at the Zarzuela Palace near Madrid, and following that took part in a ceremony in Parliament where he was proclaimed as head of state.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In the U.S., prosecutors think Wisconsin State Governor Scott Walker, a potential 2016 presidential candidate for the Republican Party, was central to a large-scale criminal scheme to illegally raise funding from conservative groups. The investigation began in 2012, but documents with the accusations were just made public as part of another ongoing lawsuit in Wisconsin. U.S. law enforcement has detained an 89-year-old man for possible extradition to Germany to face charges that he aided and abetted in the Holocaust. Johann Hans Breyer, now an American citizen living in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, has admitted to working at Auschwitz, but maintains he never harmed anyone. Priscilla Huff reports.
German authorities want to try Johann Breyer on 158 counts of being complicit in the murders of tens of thousands of Jews at Auschwitz. At age 17, he was a guard at the camp and a member of the notorious SS Death's Head Battalion. In previous cases, a judge has ruled that Mr. Breyer could not be held accountable because he was a minor at the time when the atrocities occurred. Mr. Breyer has told reporters he was aware of the deaths occurring inside the camp, but he always worked outside the camp and never hurt anyone.
And a German man has been pulled to safety after spending nearly 2 weeks in a giant cave with severe injuries. The man was one of the explorers who initially discovered the Bavarian cave in 1995. Iris Spitzer has more from Berlin.
Rescue crews emerged from the Riesingen cave system in the Alps, carrying Johann Westhauser on a stretcher. Westhauser suffered severe injuries during a rock slide on June 8th and spent 11 nights underground. Because of the cave's depth and narrow passageways, it took a multinational team of rescuers 4 days to reach Westhauser and then another week to make it back to the surface.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. President Obama announced today that he will send special forces to Iraq to train and advise the country's army in the face of the advances made by ISIS militants. He said he's not ready to launch airstrikes at this stage, although he didn't rule them out. Speaking to reporters at the White House, he made it clear that he's not willing to be drawn into a protracted military conflict in Iraq.
And going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region. I want to emphasize, though, that the best and most effective response to a threat like ISIL will ultimately involve partnerships where local forces, like Iraqis, take the lead.
The president sent the clearest signal yet that his patience with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is expiring. The White House faults the prime minister for failing to strike a political compromise with his opponents that could have undercut the militants' opportunity to strike.
Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis. Meanwhile, the United States will not pursue military options that support one sect inside of Iraq at the expense of another.
On the ground, there was more fighting today in and around Iraq's largest oil refinery in Beji. And some analysts in Iraq detect little public demand for U.S. military intervention. Michael Stevens is the deputy director of the British independent think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. He spent the day in the oil-rich northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk, and he told me what he'd seen there.
In the time that I spent in the town, it was clear that security was well looked after. We didn't see many Peshmerga actually inside Kirkuk, but what we did see were Peshmerga coming back from the front. There's a town just to the south of the city which was being assaulted by the forces of ISIS, and we saw some troops returning from the front while we were in the marketplace. We met with the governor of Kirkuk as well, and we had a chat to him, and he believes that the Peshmerga have been able to secure control of the outskirts of the city, and that's mostly where they're located. Although he pointed out to us that there was not a heavy Peshmerga presence inside the city. It felt fairly safe, and certainly the locals I was speaking to made it clear that they felt happier that the Peshmerga were now ensuring security rather than the Iraqi army.
And put the ISIS military advance into perspective for us. The Kurdish authorities said yesterday, the authorities in Kurdistan, that as far as they were concerned, Iraq was no longer a unitary state. There is, of course, intense speculation that ISIS would like to get Baghdad within its sights. One reads a lot about military incursions taking place, you know, fewer than 40 miles from the Iraqi capital. But in real terms, what kind of threat does ISIS currently pose, both to the unitary nature of Iraq and to the capital itself?
I think that it's very unlikely that ISIS would ever be able to take Baghdad, particularly given there are very heavily Shia areas with militias operating quite freely in Baghdad, and that would make life extremely difficult for ISIS. Not only that, you have the full force of the Iraqi military, which would be much harder to defeat in those areas and much more ideologically committed in those areas. So I think ISIS would be overstretching if they tried to take Baghdad, but they could, of course, try and strangle it by capturing villages in and around the Baghdad area. I think the Kurdistan area is pushing for more autonomy in the system. I think that that's part of what is happening right now, is that the Kurdish regional government is cashing in its security checks to gain more autonomy, especially over the right to produce oil. So I do think that the nature of the Iraqi state will weaken as a result of this, even if they do defeat ISIS.
And what assumptions do you detect people there making about the Obama administration's next move and its response to Nouri al-Maliki's request for airstrikes?
Yeah, there's a lot of distrust in the United States, frankly. I'm not sure most people here, really, either Kurdish or Arab, have much time for the American position. The thing really seems to feel that it doesn't look after their needs and they're self-interested. Some people have accused America of aligning with Iran and causing this problem in the first place. Others have accused America of aligning with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and starting this problem in the first place. So no matter what America does, it seems to be stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think, you know, one or two people I spoke to from Mosul clearly did want some intervention, but for the vast majority of people I've spoken to, Kurdish, Turkmen, Arab, Shia, Sunni, they don't want American intervention. I think it seems to be in mostly Nouri al-Maliki that wants it.
So when the administration here says that Iraq is a problem that Iraqis ought to be able to resolve, you're talking to Iraqis who say, yes, let us resolve it.
Yeah, I think that there's basically that line of thinking. I think some people have almost given up hope on Iraq, and a few people I was speaking to clearly want to leave for good, believing that there won't be any peace here because there's too many foreign players in the country pulling it apart. But it's a complicated one. You know, I do think Iraqis need to solve Iraqi problems, and that does seem to be what I'm hearing from when I talk to people. So, I don't think America could do much to solve some of the problems that we're seeing right now. I think that it is mostly for the Iraqis to solve. Having said that, we do have to accept, you know, as Britain and the United States, our share of the blame for what happened, and try and help in that any way we can to resolve humanitarian issues, or if we need to, security issues.
Michael Stevens of the independent British think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, and he was on the line from Erbil in northern Iraq. Now to the plight of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is marking the second anniversary of his decision to seek refuge at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Wanted for questioning in Sweden in connection with alleged sexual offences, Mr. Assange has not left the small suite of rooms that constitute Ecuador's diplomatic facility in the British capital since he entered them 2 years ago. He's been talking to reporters about the experience of living just yards from the British police who stand outside waiting to arrest him. And one of those reporters was FSN's Dan Whitehead.
Inside the small room at the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange runs up to 5 miles a day on a treadmill. He takes vitamin D tablets and gets his sunlight from a UVB lamp. He works what he calls a hacker's hours on a computer which vitally has an internet connection. His 17-hour working day is understood to involve running the WikiLeaks operations and Twitter account, while his evenings are spent watching political box sets, including The West Wing. The London Evening Standard newspaper says he spent around $17,000 on takeouts. As he remains in this limbo, the question is, what next for Assange? His argument to the US Attorney General Eric Holder is that he should stand by his word that no reporter will be jailed under his watch for doing their job.
Dealing with sources, protecting them, enabling them to engage in safe communication is a natural part of the national security reporting process. So I call on Eric Holder today to immediately drop the ongoing national security investigation against WikiLeaks or resign.
The allegations of sexual misconduct in Sweden means if Assange leaves the embassy, he'll be extradited there for questioning. But with the allegations just that, there are no formal charges, he says he's offered to be questioned in London. Outside the Ecuadorian embassy, it's reported that three police officers are standing by to arrest Mr. Assange at any one time. But what the 42-year-old is most concerned about is the questioning by police of those who visit him.
The greatest concern for me is the intelligence gathering that the British police are doing on my visitors to the embassy, aggressively demanding their names and identity details frequently as they ingress or egress from the embassy. Obviously, as investigative journalists dealing with sensitive documents and with staff under threat, that creates difficulties for me in my ongoing position.
Assange's legal team say next Tuesday it will file a relevant legal challenge in Sweden, which may move on that case. But until then, Mr. Assange's diplomatic battle continues. Inside the embassy, the TV reception, he says, is poor, but admits he has been able to follow the World Cup. Who he supports is no great surprise.
Of course, Ecuador undoubtedly deserves to win the World Cup. Also has a pretty decent team. But I think there's such prestige riding on the issue for Brazil that they are the most likely victors.
Dan Whitehead, London.
The cost of the police operation outside the Ecuadorian embassy has now risen above $10 million, according to information secured by Britain's LBC Radio as a result of a Freedom of Information request. So is it money well spent, keeping uniformed officers outside Mr. Assange's hideaway, just waiting for the WikiLeaks founder to try and leave the building? Former Scotland Yard Commander John O'Connor doesn't think so.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a complete and utter waste of money. But I think you've got to be a little bit more analytical of how the money is spent and what the extra cost is. But most of it is below the line cost. These are fixed costs anyway. The extra on top for putting these coppers there, the extra amount off the police budget comes from overtime and other incidental expenses. It's about £1.1 million, something like that. But even so, it's still an utter and complete waste of money. I can't see why somebody who is probably one of the best-known faces of anybody in the whole world, why they just can't put out an all-ports warrant if they want to arrest him once he leaves the embassy. Why on earth you have to have a police presence there? I've got no idea. I think it's an absolute nonsense, frankly. I don't know why they ever started on this. It just shows that there's such a lack of foresight. And the only reason I can think of why it's being done, it's not for national security. This is a hearts and minds game. They want the public on their side to show that this man is a pest, and they don't want any support from the public. So they're portraying him as somebody who's causing all this waste. I think it's an absolute disgrace.
Some of Assange's visitors apparently have been aggressively targeted by the Met police outside. Obviously, we don't know the full story. They're not here to defend that. But what have you made of those accusations?
I think it's probably true because there's going to be a special branch interest in the people that are toing and froing and seeing Assange to see if they're assisting him in avoiding being arrested. I mean, if I was running that operation now, what I would do, I'd probably put an observation van nearby or a couple of plainclothes coppers so they wouldn't know if there was anybody there, and then eventually withdraw. I certainly wouldn't be having all these police officers there all of the time and then interrogating people who come in and out of the embassy. It doesn't make our dealing with people's human rights, it doesn't put it in a very good light. It makes us look almost like a totalitarian country.
John O'Connor, a former commander with the Metropolitan Police at Scotland Yard, talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, and the second part of the interview Hillary Clinton gave about her new book to Canada's CBC. As we said yesterday, it is fascinating to hear the answers she gives to interviewers outside the United States, and interesting to hear the questions they ask. Peter Mansbridge, the highly regarded host of CBC's highly regarded nightly programme, The National, asks Mrs. Clinton here about Russia.
You tell a remarkable story in the book about sitting with Putin at a dinner where he talks about his parents.
That's right.
Can you tell us that story? And
I'll try to do it briefly.
Yeah, because more importantly, I want to get to what it says about him. But
thank you,
because
that's why I included it. I was at a formal dinner, and because of protocol, I was representing the United States, so I was sitting next to President Putin. And we were talking. I told him I had just recently visited the huge memorial to the victims of the siege of Leningrad, now again St. Petersburg, and how moved I was by what I had seen and learned. And he said, well, you know, it was a terrible experience for everyone. My parents lived through it. In fact, my father had been on the front, and he came home to just rest up and to try to recover before he went back. And as he was coming down the street where our apartment was, he saw a huge pile of bodies, and men were loading those bodies into a cart to take them away. And he looked at the pile, and he saw this shoe, this leg, that he thought was his wife's, and he demanded that they uncover her from under the pile of bodies. And he saw her, and he went to pick her up, and they told him, no, this woman is dead. And he said, that's my wife. I don't believe she's dead. And he argued the back and forth until finally, I think they probably just said, take her. He picked up his wife out of this pile of bodies, carries her up the stairs into their apartment, nurses her back to health. Putin is born some years later. As soon as the dinner was over, I had a meeting with my team, including our very knowledgeable ambassador at that time, Mike McFaul, expert in Russian. I told him the story. I said, Mike, have you ever heard that? And he goes, no, I've never heard that. I have since told it to other people. They have never heard it. If it's true, which of course he was very convincing in the telling, think of what that means. Think of what that tells you, not just about his personal experience, but the experience of Russia, of Russians alive today, what they went through from, you know, Stalin and purges to World War II and sieges and the tens of millions of people who were lost in that period of time, and then finally the collapse of the Soviet Union. If it isn't true, think about what that mythology tells you about his thinking, his conviction about what it means to be Russian and the kind of country that Russia should be.
What's his end game? You've seen him up close. Yeah. You've worked with him.
Right.
You've argued with him.
I have.
What's
I
his
have.
End game?
He wants to restore Russian greatness, and that includes a sphere of influence from Central Asia through Eastern Europe. Not reconstituting the Soviet Union so much as influencing and even intimidating the countries that are on that periphery so that they will follow Russia's lead. They use gas as a weapon, they use tariffs as a weapon, and then we've recently seen they use weapons as they invaded and annexed Crimea.
So what's the danger to the West?
The danger is severalfold. First of all, because I think he's kind of ad-libbing it, making it as he goes. I mean,
you really believe that?
I do. I mean, he has the overall vision, as I've just described it, about what he wants to see. But he's looking for opportunities. He's looking for weaknesses. He's looking for the potential to move forward on his vision. Remember, he really called the shots in the invasion of Georgia in 2008. Mm-hmm. And the annexation of two parts of Georgia.
And basically got away with it from the West.
Basically got away with it.
Will he get away with Crimea as he got away with Georgia?
I think right now it's too soon to tell because there is still a very active effort by Putin and either Russian military or sympathizers to continue to move into eastern Ukraine. But the final thing I would just throw in here is it's not just invading, annexing countries. He wants to create something called the Eurasian Union to compete with the European Union, and he's got Kazakhstan and Belarus, and he expected to add Ukraine to it. He is heavily influencing through money, through oligarchs and others, elections in Eastern and Central Europe, creating control over media outlets. He's in it for the long game, and the West, I believe, has to be in it for the long game. I mean, we fought wars.
Our attention span seems to drift quickly. Well, now it's Iraq.
Well, that's
kind of off Ukraine.
That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because we've got to be able to do more than one thing at a time, and it's not just focusing on the headlines. Iraq is now in the headlines, but the trend lines. What is a kind of resurgent Russian game plan mean for Europe? We know that unless Europe diversifies its energy supplies, they're going to remain dependent on Russian gas. That's not good for them. It's also not good for, you know, Canada and the U.S.
I'm glad you mentioned Canada, because
yes.
I would be in big trouble if I don't ask a question that relates to our relationship with
exactly.
the U.S. and Canada. And one of the issues on the table, and it gets quite involved in a number of different fronts, but it basically comes down to climate change,
mm-hmm.
of which you talk in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You make an interesting point at one in one area on that discussion, where you say it's a false choice to argue the economics of the situation, the climate change situation, over environmental protection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we have tremendous economic opportunities in clean, renewable energy, in using natural gas as a bridge to cleaner, renewable energy, in energy efficiency. I think that it will take careful planning to make the transition, which is what President Obama is trying to do now with the new standards on our coal-fired power plants. But it's a necessary transition, and it has economic benefits.
That's the point. Like Prime Minister Harper was arguing last week, that no country will take action on climate change if there's an economic detriment to it in taking that action.
Well, but look at what we do. And I can only speak for my country. I don't know about your policies. We highly subsidize, still to this day, fossil fuels. All kinds of tax benefits flow to oil companies and gas companies and coal companies. And although those are under scrutiny now, they still exist. Well, if the government's going to subsidize something, and that says nothing about what we do for nuclear power, which cannot be, plants can't be built or run without huge government subsidies, particularly for insurance. So the government's already got a really heavy thumb on the scale. Let's put an equally heavy thumb on the clean energy renewable side, and I will guarantee you that there is a path forward that will minimize the economic disruption as we make that transition.
Keystone, mm-hmm. yes or no?
Well, I can't say that because I was there. And
I don't understand that. Why can't you can talk about so many other things. Why can't you talk
because
about
that? Because that was a decision that rests with the Secretary of State, and my successor is going to have to make that decision one way or the other. And so I have, you know, said it's inappropriate for me to comment on it. But I would just refer you back to what I was just saying. Mm. What I would love to see, and I don't know whether this could be done, maybe could start not at government to government level, but kind of a, what we call track two discussions. But Canada and the United States are an energy powerhouse. And the decisions should not be made one by one. There should be an overall effort to plan how we can do everything from coordinating our electricity grids to doing much more to fight climate change while providing the economic and energy needs of our people. Then I would like to see that conversation go to Mexico. I think North America can be the energy powerhouse of the 21st century. But again, I would like to see us not just be the energy powerhouse based on yesterday's fuels, but to do more working together to make that transition to clean, renewable energy.
Hillary Clinton talking there with the terrific Peter Mansbridge, host of The National, every day on CBC television. You can see the encounter in its entirety on the CBC's website, www.cbc.ca. And that is the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Don't forget to keep in touch with us. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us and interact with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, thanks for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow. Goodbye.